Hear ye, hear ye, ladies and gentlemen, and all genders in between. Gather around the internet, for the infotainment podcast is about to begin. Hi, my name is Randy, and I will be your round mound of podcast sound, pound for pound, the best podcast around.
Today, we're going to talk about kind of a difficult topic for me, because, well, it's near and dear to my heart. Well, not near and dear, but more something that I have to live with the rest of my life. And it is called bipolar disorder. And I do have an in-studio guest who I'm going to let introduce herself to my listening audience.
Randy, thank you so much for inviting me. My name is Julie Linsenmeyer, and I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner. I work here in Worthington, Minnesota. I work both at the Southwestern Mental Health Community Mental Health Center and the Avera Clinic.
Okay, well, that's good to know your background a little bit, and you helped me with prescribing the right medication for me to be on, and I'm very grateful for that, because if not, things would start deteriorating. First up, I suppose we should kind of define what we're going to talk about, because there are many types of brain disorders that people might experience, more so than we think. But a lot of people have them treated and lead very successful lives. And let's see here. I have a lot of notes. It's kind of like, what is bipolar depression? The best way I had it described to me was a very basic chemical imbalance of the brain.
You are right. And it's bipolar, I think, is really one of the most complex illnesses in psychiatry to treat, because you're not only having to treat depressive episodes, which can be absolutely debilitating, but also manic episodes, which are also debilitating. And it doesn't mean if someone has bipolar that they're always either in a depressive state or a manic state. There's many, many, and in fact, most times when they're in a what we call a euthymic or a normal state. Ah, that's one of the benefits of always being on call, and I really apologize. I'll shut that off. I meant to do that beforehand. I'm sorry, Randy.
Oh, don't worry. That's happened to a lot of the so-called podcast professionals as well. I've heard that happen. So,
well, I sincerely apologize.
No, that's fine. And another way I had it described to me in very basic terms was that this was my first time that I knew something was wrong and wound up being hospitalized for it. You think you're just getting over a headache, and it's a lot more serious than that. And unfortunately, my mother was still alive at the time, and she grew up in a different era where, a couple aspirin and some Robitussin cured everything and didn't want me on medication. And, usually you say mothers are always right, and she usually was, but This time, I don't think she was. And it took a long time. And for some people, it may take a long time to realize that they're suffering from, I mean, everybody goes through depression, you know, on a day-to-day basis. But when do you realize that this is more than just a passing thing and you should seek some help for?
That's actually a great question. When we talk about illnesses or disorders, if they are impairing your ability to function, to be able to work, attend school, get through your daily activities, then that is a big sign that you need to seek treatment. And one of the problems with seeking treatment when a person has bipolar disorder is oftentimes when people are manic, they really are unable to recognize that they are having a problem. And that really is a symptom of the illness, not a deficit in the person. It's much easier to recognize when you're having problems when you're depressed than when you're manic. And maybe people around you are recognizing something is off kilter when you are having a manic episode, but you as the person are not recognizing that as such. So you'd be extremely hesitant or not at all wanting to go in and seek treatment or seek some kind of help or advice.
And that was one of my problems, is where my family could see it more than I could see it myself. I was inward looking out and they saw the outside of me, and I wasn't. For me, it was not acting normally, not seeing. I didn't mention all the things to them, but not seeing things normally and not doing normal things.
Exactly. And we think about 2.6 to 3% of adults in the United States have bipolar disorder. And in order to be diagnosed with bipolar disorder, a person needs only one manic episode, and often they will experience many more depressive episodes. And you're exactly right. As the person, you aren't really recognizing what's going on in the manic episode. And again, that is inherent in the illness. It's not at all a deficit of the person. It's just a lack of insight caused by the illness.
Now, this goes to, what do you feel are some of the common misconceptions people have about people with a mental issue?
Oh, another great question. Well, bipolar is commonly misunderstood. People will often describe it as, I feel like I'm on a roller coaster and my emotions are either up or down. But in order to be formally diagnosed with a manic episode, for at least 1 week, there's a set of symptoms or criteria that needs to be met. One of those would be the person is not needing as much sleep as normal. Maybe they need 2 or 3 hours of sleep, and then they're not tired during the day. Another symptom is that the person will have much more energy than usual, feel sometimes they describe better than they've ever felt, or they have much more irritability than usual. And these can both coexist at the same time. Oftentimes, people during a manic episode will have a sense of grandiosity, that whatever they do is the best that anything can be. They will have like an inflated sense of self-esteem. And frankly, that's a pretty good feeling. So who would want to seek treatment when you're feeling kind of on top of the world, or that finally you have all the self-confidence that you want? Oftentimes people have very pressured speech. They're talking very fast, sometimes very loudly. It's difficult for other people to interrupt the person. People can be really what we call experiencing goal-directed behavior. So for lack of better words, come hell or high water, the person is going to do whatever it is they think they need to do, whether that's finish their unfinished basement and do a construction problem, whether it's go out and buy six new cars. It's just whatever the person has in mind. If they want to think they need to go on a cross-country trip, there's people that will just get in their car in the middle of the night and do that without any ahead of time planning. It's this goal-directed behavior that nobody is really able to stop you from doing. So it's symptoms like that that other people are noticing, but the person who's experiencing the manic episode may not be noticing themselves.
For me, I think the biggest thing that triggered my manic episodes were big life-changing events. Like I remember the first time it was the loss of a job shortly before Christmas, and that year I kind of missed out on Christmas festivities. And it was the death of my mother that presented itself with another episode. And I did go through some of the things that you feel like you're on cloud nine and you can do nothing wrong. And you're just, and I did have a friend tell me, when do you sleep? And it wasn't very much at the time. And regulating your sleep patterns, eating patterns, different things is kind of a sign that, you know, if you're not doing these things well, it might bring it to a downfall, which it did for me. And for a long time, I didn't recognize those things.
Yes, you bring up another good point, Randy. Bipolar is a very genetic or heritable condition, but there are oftentimes environmental or life stressors that will kick off or trigger a manic or a depressive episode. And even the first time someone experiences a depressive or manic episode, it's often triggered by a life stressor or a very stressful event. And you mentioned a couple of those that are huge, the loss of a job, the loss of a parent. We refer to that as the stress diathesis model. So you have the propensity for developing bipolar, but then there's some stress that triggers the depression or the mania.
And I do have some things that once you come off that high and when you're on the downward slide, and one of the things was with me was having the feeling of hopelessness or worthlessness. And once when I was in treatment, I was told, well, you know you're not going to be here forever. And I thought, yeah, that's right. But I didn't see it that way at the time.
Yes, a big part of the depressive episode is a real loss of perception in that it's hard for you to see that the next day might be a little more hopeful or might be better because the brain is just inundated with so much hopelessness, maybe so much worthlessness, that it's hard to get any kind of sense of relief that might be coming in a few days, in a few weeks. And oftentimes, the depressive episodes that accompany bipolar 1 disorder are so devastating. Whereas, like you said, the manic episode, you may have felt on cloud 9. The depressive episode is just the complete opposite in how devastating it is to you.
Could you kind of explain the differences? Something I don't really know. You know a heck of a lot more about this than I do, and I should know more about it at this time, but kind of the differences between bipolar 1 and 2?
Oh, sure. Excuse me. So bipolar 1 is where there are distinct manic episodes where the symptoms last for at least 1 week. And oftentimes we think of that as a more severe form, though we're coming to a different understanding that perhaps bipolar 1 is not a more severe form of bipolar disorder than bipolar 2. Bipolar 2 disorder does not have a full manic episode. It has what we call a hypomanic episode. So the symptoms are similar. They're not as intense, and the symptoms last for about 4 days in order to meet the criteria in terms of needing less sleep than normal, maybe grandiose thoughts, goal-directed behavior. One thing with a manic episode is at least 50 to 60 people can also experience a form of psychosis when they're manic. And that can be delusional thoughts, which are fixed false beliefs, or it can be hallucinations, or it can be paranoia. With hypomania, those psychotic type events are not present. With both disorders, there is a major depressive element. Oftentimes, there's more of the depression than the hypomania or the mania. Both forms of the disorder respond very well to medication, very well to therapy, very well to learning some coping skills, but they are different in the length of time, somewhat in the severity, though both really can impair your ability to function.
Yeah, I wish I had a lesser form of it, but unfortunately not. But I, thanks to your help, I feel like I, from a year or two ago, I feel like I'm in more control of it than I was at that time.
Well, I think you've worked very, very hard to get where you are. You've learned a lot of coping skills. You've done a great job with monitoring things such as your sleep, your exercise. You do a great job with the coaching that people give you. You have outside interests that lead a great deal of quality to your life. Those factors all contribute to you being healthy.
I think that's one of the misconceptions of people with mental disorders, is that they're all a drag on society when they're not. When they, a lot of them volunteer, who work, and, well, I consider this kind of work, but it's kind of the funnest job I've ever had. But that's one of the misconceptions I feel like they have. One of the things I want to kind of pick your brain a little bit. Do you, since there is such a negative thing with all these mass shootings, and a lot of it can be linked to a mental thing, that is found out that these people were on medication and went off, and you might explain why it's necessary to, very necessary to keep staying on your medication.
Great question. Complicated question. So, unfortunately, for many mental health issues, just like many physical issues, we don't yet have a cure. So, staying on medications provides long-term relief of the symptoms and really great quality of life. Over time, we always try to decrease medications or decrease the dose as someone is stabilized. Maybe they don't need as much medication or as heavy of a dose. We try to minimize side effects. Many times for people with bipolar, because it is such a complicated illness, a person needs more than one medication, and they may need one or two mood stabilizing medications, maybe a mood stabilizing medication, and then a medication from another class, such as an antipsychotic medication, if there are or had been psychotic episodes. In terms of the mass shootings, I'm not really aware that any of those shooters recently had a diagnosis of something like bipolar. At least what I've heard in the news is that they were more like personality disorders, such as sociopaths or psychopaths, meaning perhaps the person really believed that a certain group of people needed to be targeted and killed. The shooter had no remorse. The shooter felt that the laws of society did not apply to him or her. So more instead of a bipolar disorder, a major depressive disorder, a disorder with schizophrenia, it'd be more of a personality disorder, which, yes, is a mental health disorder, but a whole different thing to treat and very, very difficult to treat.
Yeah, it probably was a mistake on my part to even bring the shooters up as far as bipolar goes.
No, not at all, because people really lump them together. And we do know that with bipolar disorder, many other mental illnesses often run with them. We call that comorbid. For example, many people with bipolar disorder, we think at least 80%, also have anxiety disorders. Many people with bipolar disorder have substance use disorders. Someone with bipolar disorder is going to be on the violent side. It's much more likely that they have an active substance use disorder, whether that be methamphetamine, cocaine, or alcohol, and that they are an active user during a manic episode, and that's when the violence tends to come out. So I think it was a very valid point that you brought up, because it's actually what a lot of people wonder when there's another mass shooting.
And I was wondering, and I brought this up before the interview, is do you feel like in like ACTs and essay tests they give during high school, do you feel like there should be psychological testing or classes on mental illness, brain dysfunction, giving some signs of recognizing when people should seek treatment?
I think classes on mental illness would be wonderful, because there really are a lot of misperceptions. And it's a common misperception for teenagers to say, oh, your moods are all over the place, you have bipolar disorder, which is completely unfounded. Teenagers' moods are all over the place because they're teenagers, but classes would be really helpful. Information is always very powerful. The tests that you're talking about are really assessing two different types of things. So like the ACT, the SAT, those are going to be tests that would assess the ability of going forward into college. Psychological tests, we actually do for some people, probably not for enough people. And so if we're seeing signs of depression, we're seeing signs of anxiety, we're not sure if there are more things that we need to be looking at, such as different types of anxiety, if we're trying to rule out ADHD, which in some cases can really mimic bipolar and also can be comorbid with bipolar in about 20% of cases. Psychological testing can be very, very helpful. Psychological testing is done by psychologists, and it's hard to get in because there just aren't enough psychologists, but they can provide a great deal of value. Some of the schools can do psychological testing as well. It's done a little differently, but that then helps the school provide accommodations for students who maybe need extra services or extra help in different areas.
I know I did go through some psychological testing, and I asked him at the beginning, was I going to be taking the Rorschach test? And he kind of laughed and probably thought it was funny that I even knew about that. And it would have been a lot more fun describing what I thought this ink blot looked like than what he did. do. But in that, I think he found I never had it explained to me like a cognitive disorder. Is that kind of linked to like a lack of concentration? Or I'm not sure of it when they use the word cognitive dysfunction.
So cognitive would be thinking. Maybe talking about what we would refer to as the executive dysfunction part, the executive functioning part of your brain, where we're thinking that you're able to organize, prioritize, plan your day, think about the tasks that you need to do and how you need to do those. People with ADHD, for example, have problems with executive functioning tasks.
And there's so many levels and so many areas of different diagnosis. And I wish there was one common thread between everything where a cure could be found. If that eventually involved some brain surgery eventually, or I know there is some devices, some uses of magnets that have helped some people. I'm wondering if you could explain some of those.
Sure. That's called transcranial magnetic therapy. And that can be very helpful for people with major depressive disorder that really has not responded well to medications. And it can be a very beneficial therapy. A person would go in for a magnetic therapy session. The session lasts, I believe, about 45 minutes, though I certainly could be getting this wrong. And there really are no significant side effects or downsides. A person needs to go for the transcranial magnetic stimulation therapy 5 days a week for about 4 weeks, and then maybe some booster sessions. This form of therapy is also being looked at for things like obsessive compulsive disorder, PTSD, that's post-traumatic stress disorder, schizophrenia. So lots more research is being done. I don't know the current research being done on it for bipolar, but I could certainly look that up for you.
Yeah, I once was described as not being schizophrenic. I've never really had a good definition of what differences from the way I act if I had schizophrenia. I was wondering if you could explain.
Sure. So bipolar is thought to be what we call a mood disorder because your mood changes. Schizophrenia is more of a thought disorder. Your perception and your thoughts are changing. With schizophrenia, people will have delusions, which are fixed false beliefs, or hallucinations, or paranoia, or disorganized thinking, or a combination of all of that, for at least a certain length of time before the diagnosis is made. And again, it has to impair their ability to function, meaning that they can't do their job well, or they can't participate in society well, or it disrupts family and home life. There are other symptoms as well, but it's a different form of mental illness. Sometimes there can be symptoms that overlap with other mental illnesses. Again, there can be comorbidities such as anxiety. Someone with schizophrenia can certainly develop depression. There's a form where a person can have schizophrenia and bipolar. We call that schizoaffective disorder bipolar type. So it's a bit of a different type of animal, but still some of the same medications can be used because they work on the same receptors that are involved in the brain.
Yeah, there's just so many layers of this that are just mind-boggling to me. That the one doctor I think who was similar to what you do and wanted me on medication when my mother did not, he said, in a scale from 1 to 10, 1 being, quote, normal, and 10 being somebody who has delusions running around with a knife or whatever, you're a 3 out of 10.
Huh.
That's one way it was described to me. And I do have, and I do this in the hopes that this interview, in the hopes that somebody may catch the fact that they're more depressed than normal or have thoughts of suicide. Hopefully they'll seek help. And for the longest time, the worthlessness part of it was discovering you have this. It's like, oh, well, how did I get out of school? Stuff like that without knowing this, without having it treated.
Oh, sure. You know, because bipolar is so complex, because people often won't seek treatment during a manic episode because they really don't think there's anything wrong with them during a manic episode, bipolar is often misdiagnosed for 7 to 10 years. And so it can be a very difficult illness to adequately treat simply because it is misdiagnosed or missed altogether. We're finding out more and more about bipolar, and we're also finding out that probably 75% of mental illnesses start in childhood and adolescence. So you're not alone when you say, I wish something could have been done sooner. Many, many people feel that way. And I really hope in mental illness and behavioral health that we keep making all the strides that we have so the correct diagnosis can be made sooner and so people don't continue to suffer with maybe the wrong medications or an incorrect diagnosis.
In my case, I was given a gene test with just a swab in the mouth, and it can help in giving you information on prescribing the right medications. Do you feel that's one of the most important things that have helped people shorten their stays in facilities if it's gotten that extreme for them? Or what do you feel is the most important stride, say, within the last 5 to 10 years as far as diagnosing someone with someone who needs therapy at the least or does need medication?
Complex question, but a very good question. So the gene testing, so it may be like the company is GeneSight or Genomind. Avera also has a test. Sanford has a test. What those tests do is they identify the medications that are most likely going to be the best medications for you to use because you can metabolize the medications the best and you have the receptors to work with the medications. Unfortunately, we don't have any tests that can tell if you have bipolar or if you have schizophrenia. Those we just have not created yet. So the GeneSight testing, I feel, is really a great test. I've used it quite a bit. It can narrow down choosing a medication and hopefully make the choice better. I think there is a lot of value to the test. I've found a lot of value in doing the test. And so I've probably done maybe 250 of them. So I have found it to be a wonderful tool. And I think the more tools we have, as long as they're good tools, the better it is. We don't yet have a test where we can see if you have the genes or the markers to tell us if you have bipolar, just because there's not just one or two genes. There's just a multitude of them as far as we know right now. So hopefully that would help us a lot too.
And just to make note, these are tests that are different from the ones you see on TV that are designed to discover your ancestry and things like that.
Yes, you are correct. These types of what are called pharmacogenomic tests talk about certain medications and whether or not the medications are likely to work for you, but they don't tell you whether you might be of Native American descent or Irish descent. They're completely different. You're right.
And also, I was wondering if you think it'd be important for us to go through some of the that may help people decide, well, this is a little more than just passing depression. Would be the mood disorder questionnaire. If it basically just yes or no questions, and I can run through some of them.
You know, actually, that excuse me, I have a frog in my throat. That would be a good idea. I don't use the mood disorder questionnaire only because people get confused by it. It's not specific enough. I'm not saying it's a bad test. It's not. It can be a really good screening tool. When people bring it into my office, and they do, I go through it with them. So I think it does have utility and value, but I have to then go through it a little more thoroughly. Like, I think one of the questions might be, we'll go through some of the questions and I'll show you what I mean.
Has there ever been a period of time when you were not, your friend or loved one was not their usual self?
So, that to me is a pretty vague question. Has there ever been a period of time when your friend or loved one was not their self? I understand, because I treat a lot of bipolar, I understand what that question is trying to get at, but I think a lay person does not understand that the question is asking about, has the person had a manic episode? Has the person experienced grandiose or bizarre thoughts? Has the person experienced much more promiscuity, which comes along with a manic episode? Have they gone out on spending sprees, which comes along with a manic episode because of that impulsivity that comes with a manic episode? That's what I mean by some of the questions are a little too vague.
Another question I have is a yes or no question, and it says you felt so good or so hyper that other people thought you were not your normal self, or you were so hyper that you, he, or she seemed to feel so good or so hyper that other people thought they were not their normal self, or were so hyper that they got into trouble, yes or no?
Tell me what that question means to you. I don't mean to be putting you on the spot.
Other people did see it in me that I wasn't acting normally. Maybe it wasn't so much that I felt so good or so hyper. It was just the odd behavior.
Sure.
And a lot of it, I think, was, and some of my friends aren't my friends anymore because of this disorder. Maybe I should add it to the list I have. Nothing can lose you friends more than disagreeing on politics, religion, and money. You can lose friends faster than a speeding bullet, but maybe I should add bipolar. I had one friend that is extremely conservative and religious and felt that I didn't need medication, that the only God was the answer to help me with my bipolar.
Oh, I'm sorry for the loss of your friendship, and that's harsh. That happens to a lot of people, but I also think God gives us the tools to help ourselves and to help others.
Yeah, I feel that medicine that helps treat that was in part due to heavenly influence to help people where just prayer will not.
That's a great point. Many people in a manic episode, when they're having delusional thoughts or hallucinations, they actually can be of religious nature. That's a big common theme. Or they can be of political nature, such as conspiracy theories. That can be a common theme. So when we're trying to diagnose someone who's manic, we automatically look for those types of themes in terms of delusional thoughts. But we also take into consideration someone's religious beliefs and cultural considerations. So that can be a fine line, but I'm really glad that medication has helped you.
Yes, I do remember instances where religion played a part. My family saw that I was carrying a Bible around where normally a person would not carry a Bible. And I was insulted that they thought it was not normal because, you know, it's not illegal to carry a Bible around. And I did go through that period, and I think in treatment I went through some religious type disorganized thinking. But you know, let's see what we got. Here's another question. You were so irritable that so irritable that they shouted at people or started fights or arguments. Well, I'm not usually either for the positive or for the negative. I'm more passive aggressive. I would bring it up in more of a subtle tone when trying to start a fight. I try to avoid those. Feeling more self-confident than usual. No, that was never even during this interview, I think. I wish I was a better... And this is kind of my first interview on this topic specifically. And it can be a very embarrassing topic for a lot of people who suffer from it. But I know there's a lot of people who deal with it that are very successful. Yeah.
Yes, there are a lot of people who are very successful. And in part, they're somewhat successful because of some of the symptoms of their disorder, because maybe they're a little more quick thinking. Maybe they tend to be on the hypomanic side. So not a full-blown manic episode, but they like only having to need fewer hours of sleep. You know, there are a lot of painters, musicians, movie stars who admittedly have bipolar disorder. A lot of creative geniuses.
Yes, if I didn't have it, I probably would have been a millionaire by now. Unfortunately, that never happened. I don't know. Is there any area you think that we have not covered or something you'd like to say to the people that think they might need help or going through the beginning stages of it? When I first started, it was like the doctors were throwing toilet paper wads in the ceiling and trying to figure out what drugs work for me, and I'm glad that part of it's been kind of gone, at least in my case.
You know, that I can appreciate your perspective on that. From a provider's standpoint, that's really frustrating as well, because when the medications don't work, it means I'm not helping the person very well. It means the person is still suffering. So, yes, I can appreciate what you're saying. One thing that I find is really helpful is when family members come in with the person, because they can give a little bit different perspective on the person's behavior, and I get more information that can provide me with a different view and can help me decide, okay, is this major depression? Might this really be bipolar? Because the treatments, the medications are completely different. Mm-hmm. So I always appreciate that. And I think it's really important that people know people with bipolar have a very high risk of suicide. About 27% of people with bipolar disorder attempt suicide. And we think about 10 to 15% actually complete suicide. That's a very, very high number.
And for those that have contemplated that, we do have a national suicide prevention number that I know has been on TV a lot with some of the celebrities that have completed this. But it's 800-273-8255 if you have or had suicidal thoughts, and maybe you can have somebody help you with those. But in the case of like Robin Williams and Anthony Bourdain, I've heard it said on other podcasts is that when you hang yourself, that's when you are totally serious about it. And when you try other forms of it that you're not as serious about doing it, I don't know, maybe I'm completely wrong about that, but I hope people would check out that number if they have gone that far or seek some counseling and medication for that.
Very important. Thank you for mentioning that, Randy.
And you feel bad. You think these people are on top of the world, and as far as a career or money and, you know, fame, and it's not all cracked up to be, you know, the best thing for some people in the end.
Very well said. Well, thank you so much for inviting me today. This was a lot of fun.
Yes. Well, there is an organization called NAMI. Is that's a nationwide deal for those that might want to check that out.
Wonderful organization. Yep, the National Alliance of Mentally Ill. They hold meetings in different communities. They also have a lot of internet support groups that you can log into. You can get some support over the net. You don't have to go to a meeting. They have a lot of just information you can access if you don't want to be part of a support group, and that can be really helpful.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of bases today, and I would like to thank you, Julie, for being a guest on infotainment. And I know this has been a heavier topic, so I'm glad you've tuned in to listen to it. Maybe it is, in my hopes, help somebody.
I hope so too. Thanks again, Randy. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Once again, I would like to thank Julie for her time today to talk about a very important topic to me and to many other people around the globe. And you can tweet my Twitters at Randy Podcaster. Check out my Facebook page under infotainment. Email me at randyms12@gmail.com and randyms12.blogspot.com for my blog. But now I think it's time to warp drive this podcast to the interwebs and say thank you for everyone for listening. May you have a happy day today and a happy ending tonight. Thank you very much. Bye-bye, folks.